Hello and welcome to the Wide World of Wargaming Warhammer 40,000 segment. As always, I am your host, Vincent Morgado. Joining me, as per the usual, Mr. Alexander Gonzalez.
Hey, how's it going?
We await the arrival of Mr. Michael Schwartz. He will be joining us shortly as he's had a disagreement with Caltrain. But in the meantime, we are lucky enough to be joined by Mr. Jim Vessel.
Hey, what's going on, everyone?
Thank you very much for joining us, sir. Can we call him the Ever Chosen of Chaos at the moment? I think he's earned that title.
Maybe, yeah.
Bringing it back, I don't think that exists in Sigmar.
No, it is. It does.
Oh, okay, my bad. Jim has been kind enough to join us to talk a little strategy, talk a little composition, and just see kind of how the health of the game is going at the moment after the first major points reshuffle of the year. Jim, first thing, if we had to put you and TJ in a room for 10 games, who comes out on top?
Well, I mean, if you go on our historic record, he would definitely come out on top. But I think if you actually watch the two games that we did play, the games were both very, very close. And, you know, ultimately when playing the mirror match, it really comes down to who rolls 2d6 better. And so in both of our games that we played, his 2d6 rolls were better than my 2d6 rolls. So that's kind of the way it goes. But, you know, if you play us, throw us a game, 8 more games, I think maybe the odds kind of swing back in my favor. So
you'd lean it towards it coming out probably 5-5 or at least 6-4?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the our current iterations of our list, the list that we've both been running, I think he has a bit of a matchup advantage. Like some of his units pair up better against me, whereas I feel like my list has a better general matchup advantage. Like I think mine is a better take all comers list, but against my list specifically, I think his list has a slight advantage. So I would probably give him a 6-4 advantage. But TJ is a good friend of mine. We talk all the time. We're actually chatting this morning, so it's all good natured. Obviously, if he beats me again, I'm gonna have to kill him. But otherwise, it's all good natured. Otherwise,
definitely. I do want to, you know, the big thing that's always jumped out at me about, and this is kind of obvious, but the Blight Lords being kind of the difference in your guys' two lists. What competitive advantage does that give him over you? Why have you decided not to make that change?
So I've actually played with the Blight Lords, and the reason that I don't the reason that I don't kind of go down that route is I prefer to have the additional command points from the second Demons Battalion, and so I run two Demon Battalions and a Thousand Suns Supreme Command, whereas he runs a Spearhead, a Battalion, and a Supreme Command. So the extra command points I find give me more flexibility in some of my harder matchups. And at the end of the day, like he has the Blight Lords and I have the Bloodletters. And against in the matchup, the shooting of the Blight Lords gives that advantage because he's able to kind of you know, do more damage over time. But I find in a lot of matchups, you know, they're quite slow. And you know, against Eldar or against Tau, you know, some of the harder matchups that you can get, or orcs even, they just don't. Well, actually, they're really good against orcs. So I take that back. Yeah. But I just, you know, I think it's just a different style, to be honest. And you know, he's had success with his version, and it's, you know, neither of us, you know, we talk a lot, but like we both have our own kind of preferences. Like my C-Beam Dreadnought is like something that I've been running since basically last summer, and everyone has always made fun of me for it, but it's the amount of games it's won me, or at least kept me into. I can't count. And you know, it's a very odd kind of oddball choice, and it's very, very weird, like, you know, specific. So it just goes down to like your play style and kind of how you like to play your games. So
yeah,
at this point, I highly doubt anyone is laughing. Alex,
oh no,
ahead.
I was going to say that Dreadnought. I feel like it always from the get-go, it always seemed kind of interesting to me that you would throw that into your list. And I actually was genuinely curious how kind of efficient it was, or if it was meant to really throw people off or turn into a distraction unit. But you know, if it's won you games like offensively, then that's fantastic. I figured it was just kind of a, yeah, like an anchor unit.
Yeah, it definitely is not, you know, it's not a, you know, it's not like a Leviathan with a Storm Cannon, which is going to just walk through your opponent. I'd say actually in most games, it's not doing a ton of killing. So, you know, in a lot of matchups over the course of six turns, it can definitely pile up. And that's one of, you know, the 72 inch range of the conversion beamers. One of the advantages of that weapon is that there's very few things in the game with 72 inch range. So in a lot of matchups, especially if we're playing long table deployments, which is essentially four of the six matchups, you can basically deploy, you know, 50, 60 plus inches away from your opponent. The strength of the model isn't so much in any one turn, but it's the fact that it can sit unmolested for, you know, five, six turns. Or if you do move closer to kind of go after it, you're going to kind of walk into my 24 inch death zone of smites and demon princes. So, you know, the resources you have to put in to kind of destroy it are often disproportional to the actual model. And then the other thing too, and this is specifically an ITC, it gives me flexibility in ITC for getting kills both early on and late game when a lot of things are cleared out or things are very far away. It gives me an ability to touch things past 24. So the army, the Thousand Suns army, it operates within, you know, a 16 to 24 inch threat bubble. And so if you end up with long deployments or end up with which is 4 to 6, and you have nothing to really hurt anything past 24, a savvy opponent can actually outrange you pretty quickly, whereas the C-beam gives you just enough threat to force them where they can't completely sit back. So that's the role specifically it plays in my list. And, you know, it's really good at taking out things like Lehman Russes, Rhinos, Ravagers. It's really good at light infantry. It does wonders against Gene Seer cults. I love it against Gene Seer cults. I love it against Guard. I love it against you know, even Tau. It can do a number to drones. It can take out quite a few drones with the 2d6 hit. So it's just so versatile, and that's really the strength that it brings to my list is the ability that it can just do so many different things.
I'm glad you brought up knights. They've been one of our, you know, very common topics of conversation. As the Castellan really did remove a lot of units that are otherwise competitive from the game. Like, frankly, the Lehman Russ until very recently. Do you foresee change? Have you made any real changes to your list since that points update? Do you see yourself moving in any direction in the future without being specific? I, of course, don't want you to have to give away any of the secret sauce.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think the rise in light vehicles, just from my experience in BAO and the last few tournaments I've played, I think, since the Castellan nerf, the meta's just starting to catch up, I think, to start to see a little bit of a swing back towards those light vehicles. I actually have a GT this weekend that I'm going to be kind of playing a little bit of a different list, partly because I've actually lost three top table games in a row. So I lost top table at Canadian Tabletop Championships to TJ. I lost top table at BAO to Jeff. And I just lost last weekend top table against Nick Not Divided by 1 point. So I've lost three top table games in a row, and I thought, well, this is probably a good time to kind of shake up my list a little bit. Plus, it's a 54 person GT, so even if I win, I think unless I win, my ranking won't move at all. Like, I literally, I think with a 54 point GT, even second place is only around 200 points, and I need 202 points, I think, in order for my score to even change. So I figured this is probably as good a time as any to kind of play around with this stuff, a few things. So I'll be running a bit of a different list this weekend. So I'm excited to see how that goes. And I think I'm starting to kind of think about Nova and the ATC, which is in about a month here. So those are kind of the next two big tournaments that I'm going to be going to. And, you know, I really, really think that there is a place for light vehicles again. And I know we've seen it a lot, especially with the rise of Eldar Flyers. And Jeff's been doing great things with those Calidus tanks. You know, Don Husen's had some great success with his list at BAO. So I definitely feel like, you know, 3 months ago with the Big Bad Castellan on the block, you just wouldn't see those lists. And I think that's really good for the game.
Yeah, one of the other units that's starting to make a bit of a comeback, both here in the ITC and then just in general, as we've noticed overseas, is the Dark Eldar Venom, which is, you know, a bit, it was a running joke just for a long time because, oh, hi, you know, two hull it at armor value 10, you basically sneezed on it. and it exploded. But I'm personally of the opinion that in the way the rules work now, the Venom is actually a hilariously undervalued unit with a super trolley 5-up if you started rolling hot. How do you feel about Dark Eldar as a single codex compared to what they can do as part of, shall we, as in Eldar Soup?
Yeah, I mean, I think outside of Guard, Dark Eldar are probably the second best single faction book. I think kind of if you think about the best single faction books, I think the top four would be Guard, Dark Eldar, Orcs, and Gene Seer Cults. I think if you took any of those books on their own, can write incredibly good lists. Mm-hmm. And the thing I like about Dark Eldar is that, just like you said, they have a lot of different varieties. So I think part of the reason you're seeing the Venom spam is a response to the rise of things like Flag Bearers, the rise of things like Gene Seer Cults and Hordes and Guard. Plus, you know, and they do well in all those matchups. Venoms do. They do really good against Plague Bearers. They do really good against Gene Seer Cults, Orcs, and Guard because of the fact that none of those armies have amazing shooting. And the Venoms move 16 inches, which is way fast if you actually think
really
about it.
Really fast. Extremely fast.
Super fast. And the thing is, you know, the other thing too is just like my list, and I think, you know, TJ's list to an extent, you know, and just like the Castellan list with Guard and just like, you know, all these kind of meta lists that have kind of come before, people eventually solve how to play against those lists and start to tailor their lists to beat them. So, you know, 3-4 months ago, you know, you knew that you'd be playing the 6 Talos, Grotesque Bomb, Triple Ravager, Dark Eldar list. Like that was the atypical, well, not atypical, that was the typical Dark Eldar list. And, you know, I've played that list against that list probably at least 30, 40 times. So when that list pops across from me from the table, I know exactly what I got to do. I know exactly how to play it, exactly how to beat it. You know, I think what you're seeing with these Venom lists is the shift of the Dark Eldar players into a different style of list in order to counteract the familiarity that a lot of players have with that kind of Coven, Prophets of Flesh focused list.
Mike, Mr. Michael Schwartz has finally joined us, sir. Thank you for managing to drag yourself in late.
Hey, guys. Sorry I was late. You know, the bills aren't going to pay themselves. I was stuck at work. It is what it is.
We tried to offer you cover by blaming Caltrans. As, you know, that's basically the easiest thing to do.
It is. It's super slow, but also convenient. So I can't blame them.
I mean, you could always be like me and be crazy and drive, but we'll never make any.
Not with this rush hour traffic. No.
That is correct. Now, we were just talking about Dark Eldar and Schwartz. Jump in here. Help us out.
I mean, besides being a fanboy for all their pain, I just think they're incredibly efficient. And I don't know what Jim has to say, but if you look at them from a mono codex perspective, the fact that you can come in with all different sub-factions means you can build a highly competitive list that can deal with everything that the meta currently has to offer just by looking at Dark Eldar. Now, of course, you can dabble into different Eldar trickery, but like the combination of the speed, the hard-hitting close combat units, the incredibly survivable units that you get from the Homunculus Covens, and just the all-around excellent performance, it's hard to beat that at this point. Of course, Jim, you can always point me in 10 different ways where I'm wrong, so please go ahead.
No, I think you nailed it, man. Like, I think everything you said is exactly on right. Like, they're such a versatile army, and you know, I think the kind of nerf to Yatari and the nerf to the cross-faction psychic powers, what you're seeing is people will take the best options whenever they can, and so they always take the path of least resistance. And so, you know, when Yunari is around, you're just going to take Yunari, you're just going to take your Farseer with your Dark Eldar. But now that stuff doesn't exist, the next best thing is kind of pure Dark Eldar. So I think I think people are kind of leaning towards
it. I think it's great. Yeah, and then what you mentioned earlier about the light vehicles, Jim, you know, the light or medium vehicles, I do see that as becoming a little bit more of a trend as well. And outside of Venoms, of course, you know, I've actually been starting to see, you know, Chimeras on the table, multiple Chimeras on the table, you know, not as much of the bad touch Hellhounds, but, you know, you are seeing a variety of
Alex still has PTSD from Hellhounds. Oof,
yeah, we don't need to talk about that. But, you know, I think that it's really interesting that you're seeing all these light and medium vehicles as well. And yeah, it's definitely because the big boy on the block is just less frequent. But, you know, when we do take a look at them, do you think that the Venom is, you know, the most efficient of those, you know, light or medium tanks or walkers, or is there another one that kind of stands out to you in particular?
Well, I mean, I think the Venom just has so many things going for it, especially if it's Cabal the Blackheart. You know, you got a built-in minus one, built-in five plus invulnerable, very fast, transport capacity, pretty good amount of shots. I think it's 12 shots within rapid fire range with the splinter cannons. Mm-hmm. And I think, and even specifically, depending on the coven, you can even get that up to an 18-inch rapid fire range. Am I wrong on the 12 shots?
You're correct. You're correct. I just pulled up the data sheet.
All right. And then, you know, you got transport capacity, which you can put five cabalites in and add another 12 shots to that. You know, you can have a 24-shot model that's basically 100, I think when you factor in the cabalites, you're talking, you know, 140 points probably for that unit. And it's got so much versatility. So I definitely feel like the Venom, and that the thing with the 6 plus feel no pain, and I believe the Venoms have 6 wounds, the 6 plus feel no pain kind of breaks the math a little bit, where it makes it almost like you have to overcommit by, with 6 wounds, you almost have to overcommit more than it seems like you do. Like the amount of times I've tried to smite off a Venom and done like 6-7 wounds and they roll 2 or 3 sixes and it's just like, okay, I got to cast a 7 smite now or, you know, another damage spell. It's just, they just don't die. You know what I mean? And it can be incredibly annoying. And if you don't kill them, they zip off and they're gone and they don't degrade either, which is great.
Yeah. So. Yeah. The lack of degradation is a critical factor in there too.
And it's the point where, you know, the 1 and 2 wound Venom, once you have missed your opportunity, they fly off, they, you know, deposit a throwaway unit of warriors on an objective, fly away into the back of the board where you're never going to see them again. And that's, you know, that could end up costing you your either multiple kill point for a turn or even just any kill at all. And we noticed in your game with Nick Nenavati, and I'm so sorry to have to bring it back up, I think the final score in that game was 24-23. Was that correct?
Wow.
Yeah, that's correct. Oh. So.
That's the Butler University Hall of Pain right there.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, it was actually a really good game. Like Nick's a great opponent. I've played him. This is my third time playing him. Mm-hmm. And in our previous game, actually about a month ago, I beat him by 1 point. I think our score is 24-23.
That's so fantastic.
So that was our game 3 at the CTC. So unfortunately for our game, I talked a little bit about this. I think before I can't remember where to someone, but we had about 12 enclosed runes on our table. So it was like it was like they decided they were going to have a Necromunda table, but 40k. So he basically was able to spend the entire game basically bunker hopping, and there wasn't actually any turn that I could see any of his models outside of an enclosed rune except turns where he charged me. So just to give you perspective of like. I literally just kind of waited in my deployment zone. He brought 3 tank commanders.
Yeah.
I think I was talking to Paul Murphy about it, but basically him and John Lennon, who's of Brohammer fame, and Colin Sherman, who's runs Best in Faction podcast, they're in a big Gene Sealer cult chat together because they all play Tyrion's Gene Sealer cult. And they had been plotting this, building an army to defeat me for a little while. Nick brought this army specifically, the tank commander specifically, so he could outrange me and kill me. And that's exactly what he did, because I had to basically hide my Contemptor all game because he had 3 Lehman Russes that shoot 66 battle cannon shots, which basically pick up my Dreadnought instantly. So my Dreadnought ended up actually just hiding behind buildings and then running and charging into combat like turn 5. Like, it didn't shoot once the entire game because as soon as I popped it out. And then there was 2 points in the game where if I had rolled a 3+, I would have won. Like, I brought one of his Lehman Russ tank commanders down to 1 wound with psychics. And my last smite, I did 1 wound and I needed to do 2 wounds. So I re-rolled my 2 into – I needed to just get a 3+ to kill it, which would have given me a headhunter, a kill more, all this, you know, all those stuff that comes
the cascade,
in.
The point cascade.
Wow.
You know, the point cascade, right? This was turn 2 because neither of us actually got a kill till turn 3.
Oh, wow.
Because we were both playing so cagey, right?
Yeah.
And then the unfortunate part was, you know, TJ was on the table next to us. We were number 1 and 2 going into that game. And our buddy Ian Stewart, who plays Custodes, basically just totally, you know, exposed his belly and he's like, I'm going to play Custodes against Thousand Sun, so I'm just going to basically throw the game because there's no way I can win. And so he gave up 41 points in his game five to TJ. So TJ leapfrogged both of us, and, you know, obviously congrats to TJ. Like, that's the way it goes sometimes. But even if I'd won by that point, I still wouldn't have won the tournament. So that's the way it goes. But.
So let's talk about Custodes since – you know, I'm sure you're aware, Jeff Robinson seems to have brought them back to the fore with his. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you are we calling that Imperial Stew? You know, what do you think of Custodes and specifically the Caladius? I mean, how efficient is that model? How efficient is that army by itself? Do you think it could ever be competitive standalone?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Jeff's an amazing player. He's probably one of the better players in North America as far as, you know, he's been playing for a long time. Definitely that army doesn't work without the Imperium components. So the Assassin, yeah, the Wyvern, the Basilisk, all the Grias stuff holding objectives, you know, pure Custodes, I just don't think has the board control, the board presence to do well, despite, you know, even if it does have, you know, three Caladiuses, and yeah, some of the new beta stuff. And I think that's kind of the other part is, you know, we're talking Forge World beta rules. So Forge World non-beta rules are bad enough. So to say nothing of Forge World beta rules, you know what I mean? Like their, yep, non-beta rules are pretty horrendous. Everything's either overpowered and then gets nerfed, looking at you, Super Demons of Chaos, or it's underpowered and overcosted, looking at you, 90% of the rest of the Forge World. So there's not really a lot of Forge World
options. As a Gen 4 Creed player, I hear everything you just said.
There's not a lot of Forge World options that feel like, hey, this was play-tested, this was tweaked, there's been a lot of like balance put into this. Everything kind of feels like they were trying to put out four Forge World indexes and one dude did it. So, you know, I think the Caladius are really good vehicles. And I think the things that make them so good is the combination of 2+ BS, fly, power of the machine spirit, and then you know, they're not that tough, to be honest. Like, they can take a hit. And I think if you have a Castellan picks up probably both of them in one turn. The Volcano Cannon picks up one, and then the other guns pick up the other one, like, realistically. Mm. But, you know, in a post-Castellan world, you know, I think they're quite good, the 60-inch range, so... And I think that's what makes them so good. It kind of reminds me of the Seething Dread, which is that 60-inch range makes it so that almost all the major anti-tank, Dark Reapers, which, again, are kind of seeing a downturn, you know, other tanks, las cannons, those just get outranged. And they just, you know, you just pick up – it's just hard to kill,
yeah, them. Well, I mean, the Caladius Plus, I mean, not only is he the 60-inch range, but he is also, what, like 12 or I think even 14-inch move with fly. So you really can't hide from it. And it's got, what, the 8 shots that do D3 damage. It's bringing the hurt to almost everything. You know, if it's something with an invulnerable save, it's going to force the invul more often than not. If or actually every time, you know, if you have damage control, you know, it's good against basically anything that's not just – 30 orcs, you know, and even then all shots into a mob is not horrible if that's your only target. It's, I don't know, my quantum shielding gets the bad touch from that D3 damage. It's fun.
Yeah. It's basically, if Dark Reapers were a tank, it would be the Caladius, because it's basically, it shoots like a unit of 8 Dark Reapers for about, I think actually less points than 8 Dark, yeah, Reapers, and it's way harder to kill.
I mean, it's easily 30, 40 points under cost. I mean, yeah, because right now it's packing in a 210. It's just nothing else in the game can bring that much efficient shooting for the price point, simply because with a 2+ mm-hmm. and the rerolls that you gun with the grav tank. I see the replay of the of your game with Jeff of BAO. They were very efficient shooting, albeit turn 2 where you made all those saves with your plague bearers. The Caladius seemed really inefficient shooting your infantry, but that was it. Everything else it was really good at.
For sure. But it also, knowing how efficient that shooting was, it definitely put me in a position where I had to play differently. Like if that's a unit of guard tanks, you know, I laugh at it because I'm like, okay, have fun hitting me on fives. But, you know, with a 2+ BS in the 60-inch range, they're just so versatile. There's nothing else for that. There's no other gun platform in the game for that amount of points. that has that much firepower, that much movement, and then so many other special rules stacked on top. We're talking 5+ invulnerable against shooting. We're talking -2+ to charges. So it makes it really hard to, you know, deep strike in and try to take one out. You literally have to, you know, walk your way up there. And that was actually something that cost me in my game against Jeff, which was my Corn Prince charged the one Caladius, and I was 5 inches away, and I rolled a 6. And so I had to spend a command point to make the charge. And of course, I only had 3 command points, so that prevented me from fighting twice and killing him.
Yeah.
And that was actually a huge swing because I ended up not getting a kill that turn. But I only managed to do I brought it down to 1 wound. And had I gotten a kill that turn and, you know, killed the Caladius, you know, that totally changes that game again, right? So just small things like that, you know, really just kind of push it over the edge for 210 especially.
And also, it's – I'm going to – sorry, Mike, let me jump in here. It's not just the shall we say, the hypothetical effect of the -2. It's the blocking potential you can use a model of that size for with its -2. And, you know, the way it can wall off other units from essentially being charged at all. Did you watch any of Jeff's game against Don Houston?
I did not, sorry.
So Don, who is notorious for bringing – whatever Don wants to bring, you know, he's one of those super experimental guys. Mm-hmm. He brought triple hell turkeys. And one of the things that happened was he failed a multi-charge that would have given him locked up 3 units because one of the ones he charged was the grav tank. And it just bought Jeff an extra round of shooting that led to, you know, like we said, the cascade. It's like once one pebble starts, then another and another. And Don ended up basically getting boarded. Despite what, you know, by any stretch would be a well-played and very well-written list that's not, I mean, I won't say entirely like yours because you have a lot more infantry, but also reliant on a lot of large, high-point dense creatures.
Yeah, and I think Jeff's list definitely has the firepower to pick up those kinds of lighter vehicles.
Jim, I wanted to ask, you mentioned before how you played differently against Jeff or how against you played differently against very shooting armies like the Caladius. Like, can you talk to us about the strategy that you imply with the infantry? Because I noticed you deep struck the majority of your army against Jeff. Is that something that's a typical tactic or do you have more board presence starting off? How do you know how do you pick and choose the approach you take versus the generic list that you're facing? And you don't have to get that into it if it's like a multi-long conversation, but just I'm curious to get into the mind of you approach each of your opponents.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about it. And that actually harkens back to my point earlier talking about TJ's list and why I prefer the extra command points. So in some matchups, especially against things like Tau, a heavy, very heavy shooting guard, So I'm thinking, you know, Punishers and or things like Triple Cross Crusaders. So one of the typical downsides of Plague Bears is Warp Surge, which is the stratagem that gives you +1 in your vulnerable save. You have to use it at the start of the phase, which means if you have any level of intelligence at all, as soon as I choose that unit to warp your Warp Surge, guess which unit you shoot? You shoot the other unit. So in matches where there's going to be very heavy shooting against me, so against Jeff, I played Richard Ziegler the previous round. He had triple Riptide Tau. I played another army. I can't remember what it was. I think it was Guard in my first game. And he had 2 Punishers, like Lehman Russ, like so all that kind of shooting. I'll often deep strike one unit of Plague Bearers. And what that allows me to do, especially depending on the board state, so if we're playing Dawn of War or a shorter deployment, I might not do that because no matter what I do, they're going to be able to shoot that one unit of Plague Bearers. Whereas on a longer board like against Jeff, I might deep strike a unit and then basically do all the buffs, so -2 to hit and a 4++ on the other unit, the one that's on the board. And that just essentially gives them nothing to shoot at except a unit that's -2 with a 4++. It also allows me to concentrate things like my 2 command points to auto pass on a single unit. So a really smart player, if they're playing, say, a Plague Bear list, so all you anti-chaos generals, listen up. If there's 2 units of Plague Bears on the board, first they'll wait for you to warp surge one. And this is especially if this is, say, turn one and you're trying to alpha strike this Plague Bear list, they'll wait till your turn one. You'll warp surge one, you shoot the other one. But once you've done, say, 7, 8, 9, 10 kills, you start to shoot the other unit. And what you do is you put the Plague Bearer player in a position where he's got a risk rolling dice on a unit, and he's split now his Warp Surge or his Miasma. So he's got one unit that's -1, one unit that's -2, or often both units, maybe if it's turn 1 or -1, and one's Warp Surge. And you put him in a position where at the end of his turn 1, he has to either roll for a unit. And again, that one is great, but it's not guaranteed. There's been so many games where I've literally never rolled the one for all the games that, you know, everyone always remembers the time where I rolled the one, but just as many times I've not rolled the one and had the unit disappear, right? So the reason I like to deep strike the unit is because I think it creates a harder choice for my opponent, and it gives me, it's almost a defensive play, right? In a lot of ways. And then what it does is it guarantees me a full strength Plague Bearer unit for turns 2+. And that's really important as well. And I know I'm going to get a unit that's going to come in at full strength that I can Miasma, that could be my kind of my real screen unit. So then the first unit ends up being kind of a bit of a throwaway. And in a lot of matchups, you're going to lose a unit of Plague Bearers. And it's better to lose one in the first 2 or 3 turns and have another one that's kind of full than lose both of them early, or put you in a position where you're having to spend a lot of command points or take risky plays. So I just find in certain matchups, the ability to have that deep strike, that second unit, is really important, especially against Tau, which can be a very tough matchup once they get marker lights on you, especially against Guard. And again, I always say, you know, people always ask me, I get probably about 5 questions on Facebook a day. They say, well, what do I do in this matchup? And the thing I always say, well, it depends on terrain, depends on your deployment. Those are the two most important factors when it comes down to how you're going to play the game. Those two factors are more important than anything else, because on long deployments, short deployments, heavy terrain, light terrain, places where you can hide versus you can't hide, that's really going to affect how you play the game. And there's no one answer, right? I can't just say, oh, always deploy 2 or always deep strike 1. It just really depends on, and their list as well is also a big factor. Makes sense. So it's just the flexibility that's important.
Is there ever a time, Jim, where you go full overload with the demon drop and essentially both Plague Bearers, the blood letters, all the horrors? I mean, you just slam everything 9 inches from somebody's face and go, there is no way that I'm going to fail all these charges.
So, I would deep strike both of these Plague Bearers. I'll have nothing left to protect my characters and they'd all die. That's generally not recommended, because I don't really have much else besides some Nurglings and Brimstones, which are pretty easy to kill. I've actually had games where my game 7 at Adepticon, I did just that. I deep struck one unit of Plague Bearers, and I had another unit move up to screen my characters, and I was playing against a shooty orc army, and they were Miasma, they were Warp Surge, everything, right? Thinking, you know, they're gonna live through his first shooting phase, and it'll be no problem. And he first goes to he had 2 Gorkonauts. I'll give you the short of it. He had 25 Ludas. This is obviously pre MOBA nerf, but he had 25 Ludas, 2 Gorkonauts, and then he had the Relic Shock attack gun plus like 3 tractor cannons or something like that. And he proceeds to roll a 3 for his Ludas. This is first thing he shoots. He shoots his Ludas. He picks up 18 Plague Bearers for the first roll of Ludas. Of my 30. So there's 12 left. There's 12 Plague Bearers left. He shoots them again, because it's obviously 3 again. Yeah. And before he actually even shoots me, he asks me, he's like, I said, no goddamn way, I'm gonna make you roll those dice. Sure enough, one Plague Bearer survives. So at this point, it's game six of Adepticon in like the finals. I have a single Plague Bearer screening my entire army against 2 Gorgonauts and 3 cannons, not the tractor cannons, but the ones that shoot D3 shots, the mega cannons.
The shock attack.
I can look it up.
What are they called?
Yeah.
The mega cannons.
Anyway.
Long story short, because he'd already used his Daka Dakas, and I miasmed them, and it's a start of the phase for the minus, right? So everything else in his army's hitting that one flank around 6s.
Sure.
And sure enough, it tanks an entire Gorkonaut.
Oh my god!
And all 3 of the guns, and it finally dies to the last Gorkonaut, the second Gorkonaut. So in that case, had I, you know, like that was a case where like he had the firepower to pull 30 Plague Bearers up turn 1, and he did. but I was able to kind of survive, like kind of like get through it. But I definitely wouldn't recommend doing it. Even in that game, in retrospect, is a bit risky. And I actually think in Jeff's game, I should have just kept both units on the table. Thinking back on it, the reason I should have kept two units back on the table is because he ended up dedicating a lot of firepower to kill my Dreadnought, and he didn't end up really shooting at my Plague Bear as much turn one anyways. So in retrospect, I probably should have just started both units on the table, and that was my mistake.
I do one other question about demons, because for some reason they are always a list that I personally have trouble with, regardless of what edition it is, what army I'm playing, what list I run. Demons piss me off. specifically the Bloodletter Bomb. Is this the prototypical 9-inch drop and then 3d6 rerollable charge bomb? Is that what that is?
Well, it's not rerollable because I don't have a Khorne. If you have like the Khorne Locust, which is like a pure Khorne battalion, is, but mine's just 3d6.
Yeah, so it's very hard to fail.
3d6 plus one. So essentially, yeah, because they get plus one for the musician. So you got to roll an 8 on 3d6. It's very hard to fail, but I probably failed it at least once every other tournament. I think I fail it. And that's even with a command reroll and a Gaze of Fate reroll, which I think brings the chance up to like 97%.
God, that's painful.
And I actually had one tournament where I failed it. I failed it three times in one tournament. It happens.
Right? Yeah. Any game with dice. Any game with dice.
But it's a lot better to fail that charge than to forget your blood letters off the table.
So. I wasn't going to bring it up. it didn't seem like that. Well, anyway. Somebody, guys, I cannot be the only one with questions.
I have a ton of questions.
There we go.
Sure. I was going to say, I am constantly surprised by the Pink Horror's efficiency. Can you walk us through that arm? Every single time I get shot up by Pink Horrors, I'm going like, I'm sorry, it's how many shots and why do they get the plus one to wound? And just walk us through that unit, because it always catches people by surprise. At least it catches us mid-table heroes by surprise. Maybe it doesn't catch the top players by surprise anymore. But it's just like, do you use them to deep strike a lot, or do you deploy them on the field, or is it one of those like deep striking snipers turn 2-3 situation?
So the only time I generally deploy them is if I'm playing the only times I've ever actually deployed them on the table is when I'm playing Gene Seer cults, because Gene Seer cults generally have very little shooting.
There's no threat to the horrors.
And my horrors will generally be behind my flag bearers. And Gene Seer cults are generally coming at you with las guns. And if they're getting close enough to shoot my horrors, they're probably not going to survive that long with las guns. So, and I've done that a few times. I've definitely deployed them on the field a few times. Generally, yeah, I'm going to deep strike them almost 90% of my games. The shots, again, so with a reroll of ones for just shoot.
Everyone forgets.
So Thousand Sons Princes give, this is actually, I feel like it's a well-known rule, but a lot of people forget. So Demon Princes give rerolls, even if they're from like a Heretic Stardust book, so Chaos Space Marine, they give rerolls to the god that they're aligned with. So Zeench Demon Princes from Thousand Sons give rerolls to Zeench Demons. Khorne Demon Princes give rerolls to Khorne Demons if they're from like the Chaos Space Marine book. It's something that like a lot of people actually don't believe me when I tell them. I always have, that's one of the most often rules where people call me on it. They're like, no, I don't believe that. Like it's not a demon prince. I'm like, okay, like fine, I'll show you. And then so the change caster, which gives them plus one strength, he's 65 points. So he actually went down in the chapter proof, which is great. And Flickering Flames, the spell that gives him plus one wound, casts on a 5+.
Wow, that's
plus,
super
actually
cheap.
Kind of crazy. Yeah, it's super low. So combining those two kind of pieces, a unit of that's just under 200 points. So I run 25 just for points perspective, but most people run 25 to 30. Puts out between 75 and 90 strength plus one wound. And against like things like anything with like a 3+ save even. So I played at BAO. I shot all of them at Mortarion, and I think they did like 8 wounds because it's just sheer volume of saves, right? So I think I ended up doing like 27 wounds to Mortarion. After my hits and my wounds, I did 27 wounds. And if you have a 3+ save, you roll 27 dice. Yeah. They're gonna fail a lot, and so they're actually quite effective against 3+ save or higher. Against 2+ save stuff, I mean, they obviously lose a lot of efficiency. But yeah, they're such a versatile unit, and I think where people underestimate them is how survival they are. I mean, they have a 4+ invuln, and 25 wounds 4+ invuln is pretty hard to shift. They've won me games not on their shooting before, but on their just not dying. Like, they tank. I don't know if I just get lucky with my 4+s, but against Juice at Adepticon, my final game, they won me the game there. I charge with them a lot, and obviously I'm sure people have seen my blue horror trick by now. So that's not a surprise to anyone, but that often catches people off guard as well.
Please elaborate. Elaborate your blue horror trick. For those that don't know, elaborate. Please tell.
Yeah, so it sucks because now every time I charge them in tournaments, people just don't shoot them anymore. I'm like, God damn it. I shouldn't have said anything on that podcast. So basically, I have 5 enforcement points in my list for a single blue horror. And when I need to get the pink horrors into combat, I'll often charge units with quite a shooting. So in one example, I actually charged a knight with an Avenger Gatling cannon, even though I had no intention of going near it. It was within my 12 inches, so I decided to charge it. And sure enough, the opponent took the bait, shot his rapid fire battle cannon, or his Avenger Gatling cannon, killed. He ends up killing only like 2 or 3 horrors. But what that allows me to do is that the first one that dies allows me to split off a blue. And the rules for placing splits is very clear, which is they have to be outside of 1 inch of an enemy, but within 2 inches of a coherence. But within coherency of another model from the unit that was there at the start of the phase. So basically, you put your horrors down. You charge something that's, say, 10 inches or 11 inches away, or anything with shooting. They shoot one or two and kill them from Overwatch. And then you place your blue horror down closer to the enemy. And it actually turns a 9-inch charge into a 6-inch charge. So I've done the math based on base sizes and how much extra distance you get. It basically turns a 9-inch charge into a 6-inch charge for your horrors. And it can catch a lot of people off guard. And it's definitely it's definitely won me games being able to do like a 6-inch charge and wrap things or tag things that people didn't think I was going to be able to get to, or even like against Tau sometimes, people don't expect you to charge horrors into them. But if you can charge in and tag them and tag broadsides or tag, lemuresses and stuff like that, it's 100% worth it. Because once they kind of drop down, most people will put enough energy into them that their subsequent shooting is not as good. So it's definitely worth going for it.
So how often, when those type of situations occur, do you get the feel badsies from your opponent? And if so, how do you deal with that?
I don't think I've ever had anyone, here's the thing. At the end of the day, you're not getting charged by a bloodthirster or, this devastating combat unit. You're getting charged by horror. So it's not like they come in and they kill you, right? They don't actually do any damage. Like, literally, they do nothing. They just get to move. And at the end of the day, I could have just as easily rolled a 9. And funny enough, I feel like 70% of the time when I do that trick, they just sort of roll a 10 anyways, and they make it regardless. So it's not necessarily it improves my chances of a charge, but it's not like a gotcha moment where it's like it allowed me to do something I wouldn't otherwise have normally been able to do. Or it wasn't like out of left field. I declared a charge with horrors. At that point, he thinks that I got to roll a 9. And based on his Overwatch, now I got to roll a 6. So that's not that big of a gotcha. It's just obviously kind of like, oh man, it's more of a kind of damn it. That wasn't worth it to kill the 1 or 2 blue pink horrors for you to get a 3 inches extra on your charge.
Yeah. Okay. And, with the success of this demon army overall, you're multi-faction or chaos soup, with the Thousand Sun Detachment and the demons combined. Do you have any interest in any of the other, chaos units that you haven't necessarily explored yet? Lord Discordants are very popular right now. Chaos Knights are right around the corner, things like that.
Yeah, I have 3 Lord Discordants in boxes that I need to paint. I also really think the Slaanesh Mirror has a lot of promise. So I'm not home right now. I'm not home for another week, but that's probably going to be the next thing I put together and paint when I get home. And I really want to, especially with this latest FAQ, I don't know if you guys saw the latest FAQ with it, but they basically FAQ'd it that if a flyer tries to fall back within 6 inches and fails, it just explodes.
Yeah. What?
So
no, I yeah. saw that. It was fantastic.
So basically, because it makes it so it can't fall back. So I'm thinking with all these Eldar flyers, right? You know, you maybe charge it, like you do something even sneaky. So you say charge plague bears, and now you can't charge a flyer, but you can pilot and consolidate into flyers. So you could do something like where you say charge one unit with your plague bearers and then slingshot one half of the unit into, say, two or three flyers, run your mirror up next to them. And it's got a psychic power that gives everything around 12 inches minus one leadership. So they have to roll. And I actually read the rule recently. You have to actually beat the – you have to actually roll less than leadership, not equal to or less. So it's 3d6. If you're leadership 9, you have to actually roll you have to roll a 10 or more. It's not a 9 or more. So you have to roll you have to roll an 8 or less on 3d6 if you're leadership 9 to get away from it. And if you don't, if you're a flyer, they just automatically explode. So I feel like with all these other flyers, it could be like a you know one of those. That'll be a field dead moment for sure.
That's going to be a gotcha on a couple on more than a few people, I think.
Oh, and the other thing is, guess what one of the Slaanesh powers does? Minus one to hit. Closest. So you could have Plague Bearers in combat with something that can't fall back, that are minus three to hit. That basically
yeah, no, seriously, you're like, never going to shift those things.
Well, when the Epitome first came out, it's such a funny unit because it's fast, it can hit relatively hard, albeit it's not going to win you games in combat, but just the fact that it's great at debuffing things and screwing with your army is just phenomenal.
Yeah, and I think the other two really strong parts about it is the 2+ mortal save, especially in the current sniper meta, the 2+ mortal save makes it really resilient. It actually has 8 attacks, so it's almost up to the level of the Demon Prince for attacks, and they're damage 2 and damage 3, albeit some of them are AP 1, on 6s or AP 4. Plus, there's actually, you can give it a Forbidden Gem, which is another gotcha, right? So if someone's got a Hemlock, a Crimson Hunter Exarch, guess what? If I say you can't move at the start of the phase, then that pulls up too. Yeah. It's a character, right? And there's a stratagem in the Slaanesh book that gives anything within, I think, 3 inches of a Slaanesh unit at the start of the phase minus one attack. So you could basically charge. And so my plan currently is to kind of run it literally right behind my Plague Bearers, kind of like bringing up the rear. And it's going to be hard to snipe out. It's going to, buff up the Plague Bearers, keep things in combat with the Plague Bearers. I think it can be, and it's 195 points, so it's about the same price as a Demon Prince. And you get plus two casts, two denies, and you get plus one to both of those. So I think it's a bit of a sleeper hit. I don't think people have kind of caught on yet.
I'm not done taking notes yet. I'm not done taking notes yet. My entire plan. Yeah.
We really just use this podcast to talk to better players than us, and eventually one day
we'll be good. Yeah, that's the goal right there.
The listeners are basically irrelevant.
I also think it's going to be hard to use. I think the lack of fly is going to mean that you got to be really really careful with how you use it, because it can definitely get, especially if you're running it behind, say, Plague Bearers, it can definitely get caught up in that screen. But the one thing that I think a lot of players they just don't realize is like with a 32 mil bases with 2-inch coherency, you can actually basically fit almost a 60 mil base through them to within an inch of an enemy. As long as you keep your gaps quite wide, you can actually charge your Epitome right through in between two Plague Bearers into combat. So there's ways to kind of keep it engaged, even if I think it's got a weird oval base, so you can basically like torpedo it through Plague Bearers and just have the tip, which is pretty typical for Slaanesh, sticking through to
my bears. Yeah, I was going to say that's a very Slaaneshy description of the geometry there. Well, sir, we are coming right up on the appointed time, and we do really appreciate you taking a couple of minutes to walk us through how you view the game and how your list works. We really hope to bring you back at the next possible venture. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no worries. I'm off to GT this weekend, and hopefully I'll have some good news, because it sucks. It sucks losing. So.
Well, somebody has to bear the bridesmaid title at some point in 40K. Jeff labored under that title for how long?
Yeah.
I mean, it's always somebody. So we wish you the very best of luck this weekend, and please do hurry back to join us. Alex and Mike, let's go ahead and sign off. And that was a privilege to listen to. Listeners, what you just heard was a clinic on how to approach top level 40K.
I feel like I'm a lot better player just by listening to it.
All right.
Nothing can save me. You two at least have hope.
Oh boy.
The power of YOLO is too strong for me to ever be good at 40K.
We were talking about that earlier. The whole Nick's list last week, even, you know, the multiple Rust list. You can play Rusts and do good. You choose not to.
I don't need your, I don't need that. You leave me alone and let me wallow in self-pity, goddammit.
Oh my God, I hear it from here.
Oh boy.
Let's go ahead and sign off, gentlemen.
All right. Have a good night, everyone.
Talk to you later.
Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all the time thing. You don't win once in a while, and you don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. Winning is a habit.